We're back. That was a brief break.
That was a break.
And that was, you know, sometimes we go under the radar when we do our identification. This is the Taylor Report, and we are available on Facebook, and we're on SoundCloud. And I think we are joined by Stephen Cowens. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
How you doing? I'm sorry to hold you up there a bit, but
no problem.
We got you. Israel, a beachhead in the Middle East, from European colony to U.S. power projection platform, Baraka Books. I think it's a terrific book. I'm glad you wrote it. I was introducing earlier in the program, I cited some quotes at the beginning, and the one I like best is Benjamin Netanyahu speaking in 1993, and he said, you have him quoted, Israel is the West's outpost in the Middle East. Is that true? How did this happen? If they're the outpost, why aren't the other countries in the area the outpost?
Israel is the outpost of the West and the Middle East because Israel is a colonial settler state, and the settlers are European. And the vision for Israel was initially articulated by Theodor Herzl, who was an Austrian journalist who he was working at the end of the 19th century. And he was looking for a way for Jews to escape the anti-Semitism of Europe. And his view was that the way to do that was to establish a state elsewhere, a state for Jews. He suggested Palestine, a return to Jerusalem and Palestine. And he thought the way to accomplish this was by getting the sponsorship of a European power. So in return for that sponsorship, what he suggested was that Israel, or this Jewish state, would act as the outpost of civilization in a sea of barbarism, as he put it, or the outpost of the West in the Middle East, and it would look after the interests of whichever colonial power wanted to sponsor it.
Mm-hmm. It did. We, of course, today, as your term is, it's a platform projection of U.S. power, but initially, it was the British regarded themselves as being the great maritime power. They're the ones who could determine who could have a state and not a state and who might make a colony, et cetera, right? I was struck by your citations in the book. They really understood what they were doing. The idea of where we're going to return this people of a certain religion to their homeland. They understood that was the concept they were working with, right?
Who was working with?
You cite people writing in the 1700s saying that sort of like their reading of the Bible opened the door to this possibility.
Oh, yeah. And that's something that's very interesting about Zionism. Zionism, which is this movement for the ideology of Jewish migration to Palestine to recreate the Jewish state of antiquity. It's often thought that Zionism is a Jewish ideology, and there are parts of Zionism that have been articulated by Jews, such as Herzl, but is initially a Christian ideology, one articulated by, in particular, evangelical Christians who wanted to facilitate the migration of Jews to Palestine because they believed that this would fulfill a biblical prophecy, mm-hmm. And would create the conditions for the return of Jesus to earth. Mm-hmm. So very early on, I mean, there was this kind of this Christian Zionist movement. European powers, I think a number of European statesmen, particularly those who spent a lot of time reading the Bible were the ones who were the most interested and the most zealous advocates of Zionism.
Yeah, so it now as in the beginning, right? I mean, we are certainly seeing when Trump did this really shocked the world kind of thing, he opened an embassy in Jerusalem, and his daughter was there. She was accompanied primarily by Christian Zionists who gave some pretty chilling remarks. If someone wanted to study it, I'd say probably ought to listen to them and hear what they're saying as opposed to, you know, the something from the State Department.
Yes, or you could even go to the State Department, since the leader of the State Department at the moment, Mike Pompeo, is a Christian Zionist, right-wing evangelical. Mm-hmm. In that movement, that right-wing evangelical movement, is one that believes that support for Israel is something that God demands.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's an apocalyptic aspect to that, right? The notion that the end gathering would bring about the return of Jesus and the judgment, day of judgment.
Exactly. So these people are
something that everybody longs for.
And they're ardent supporters of Israel, but that doesn't mean that they're particularly attached to Jews or particularly attached to Zion or particularly attached to particularly attached to Jews, excuse me, or that they are necessarily anti-Semitic, are necessarily opposed to anti-Semitism. I mean, their concern is with their own salvation or the salvation of the righteous.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably, under this scheme, the Jews would not be among the righteous who ascend to heaven with Jesus.
But they would be given. My understanding is the apocalyptic vision is they're given a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You might say the last chance. I mean, it's really, by the way, it is really grim. I wish people would talk about it more often. The blood-curdling visions behind these people, who, as you point out, one of them is Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm. the other is the current president of Brazil, Bolsonaro. Mm-hmm. Also another Evangelical, Christian Zionist.
I have to say, my first awareness of this was I was watching late night, why I don't know, a Christian evangelical program in about 1 a.m, and the guest was Benjamin Netanyahu. This would have been 20 years ago. And he said, we have to acknowledge you were the first Zionists. And I actually had never heard that. I hate to say it. I was kind of shocked. But so it's not something disputed. He didn't quibble about it. He said you were the first Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
But carrying it forward, you point out Woodrow Wilson. Of course, we come to Mr. Balfour. We come to Mr. Churchill. Well, in the case of Churchill, there's probably a little more ambivalence as to what the heck he believed. But they had an issue that they thought that the Zionist movement helped solve, and that was the issue of popular revolutions, particularly the French Revolution, the concept of liberty, equality, and fraternity, right?
Yes. Now, again, this goes back to Herzl. Herzl saying, okay, we need sponsorship of a European power to establish our state in Palestine. So what can we offer them? And he was very explicit about this. So he looked at all of the benefits that might accrue to the sponsorship of this state. And he pointed out, well, one of the benefits could be this. Many Jews are inspired by left-wing ideologies. They're inspired by Marxism. They're inspired by communism, he said. And one of the ways in which you can deal with the problem of this growing revolutionary energy in Europe is by providing an outlet, essentially the outlet of land ownership. Allow these frustrated Jewish socialists and Marxists to leave Europe and go to Palestine and essentially become landowners there. But this is a process that happened, you know, outside of Palestine as well. I mean, also the argument that this was also going on with migration from Europe to North America, and migration not of Jews, but of others, migration to North America, to Australia, to New Zealand, etc., which was kind of an outlet or a safety valve, which allowed Europe to avoid the revolutionary energies of the frustrated lower classes.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans. The book is Israel, A Beachhead in the Middle East, From European Colony to U.S. Power Projection Platform. I want to mention, too, by the way, that there's a great review of this book by Philip Rodas in the Off Guardian. By the way, Stephen, did you see that review?
Yes, I have.
I rather liked it. You're the author. Did he kind of get you right in his assessment of your book?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yep, it was very good.
Yeah, he takes up something. He starts off with this point about Churchill, who's a revered figure in the West. Mm. We can hardly have a speech any importance without somebody quoting Churchill. But on this point about the outlook of the leaders of the empire. He says that he quotes Churchill about the very phenomenon you mentioned, that the tendency of Jews as an oppressed people in Europe to be attracted to democratic and progressive ideas, and this the way he spoke of them was frankly had all the hallmarks of anti-Semitism, and Martin Gilbert, his biographer, calls it casual anti-Semitism. I didn't know you could call anti-Semitism casual, but what's your take on that?
Well, I've spent a lot of time looking at Hitler and looking at Hitler's views. And what's striking about his views is that they are not atypical for the European conservative movement. We have a tendency to regard Hitler as a category in his own, as some kind of sui generis, but he's not. His views were quite consistent with those of other central figures in the conservative tradition, among them Churchill, and also among them Herzl, by the way. Herzl and Hitler, Herzl and Churchill, Herzl and many conservative thinkers shared very similar views. But Hitler and Churchill and a number of others, these people aren't unique. This is also true of, say, Mark Sykes, who is a British official.
Sykes-Picot, yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. The British cabinet, the French statesmen, they all had this view that Jews were behind, or Jews, were in the background manipulating world affairs, but they were particularly responsible for revolutions. So they believe the Jews are responsible for the French Revolution, and they believe the Jews are responsible for the Bolshevik Revolution. And, of course, Hitler had his idea of the Judeo-Bolshevik menace, that the Bolsheviks were all Jews, and the Bolshevik Revolution was a Jewish conspiracy to destroy Western Christian civilization. Well, Churchill's views weren't that much different from Hitler's. Churchill certainly had the view that, there are Jews manipulating, or Jews had this enormous influence in the world, this kind of subterranean influence. But he wrote an article in which he divided Jews into three groups. He had two groups. There are the bad Jews and there are the good Jews. The bad Jews were people like Trotsky, Radek, Kamenev.
Emma Goldman.
Emma, yes.
Lived in Toronto, I got to admit. Died in Toronto. Go on,
yeah.
Sorry.
So these Jews, which are essentially Marxists or anarchists or communists, they were the bad Jews. The good Jews, you pointed out, were the Jews who were going to Palestine and essentially taking other people's land, but we're going to Palestine. Or the people, also good Jews, are the people who are going to stay in Europe, the Jews that would stay in Europe, but we're going to be loyal to the established.
Yeah, he had a phrase which you quote, in harmony with the empire.
In harmony with the empire, and weren't committed to what he called the impossible idea of equality. And that was the problem with people like Trotsky and Zinoviev and Emma Goldman. They were proponents of the idea that you could create a world of universal equality. So they were the bad Jews.
It's very important to stamp that out.
Yeah. And that's the same view that Hitler had. I mean, what was the Judeo-Bolshevik virus is essentially this whole idea of impossible equality comes from the Jews. That was the view. It's a conspiracy against Western civilization. Now, I said that Herzl also shared similar views. Obviously, Herzl wasn't anti-Semitic. But he did have the same kind of views about hierarchy and the importance of the establishment and about the impossibility of equality and an opposition to a world of universal equality. So he stood very much within the conservative tradition.
Mm-hmm. This is Stephen Gowans. Churchill was a leading element. The British certainly were. Sykes-Picot and the famous Balfour. Balfour seems to be the central declaration everybody works from. So walk us through how it went from being a concept and something carried out by the British to this hegemony now of the United States.
Yeah, well, the British were particularly interested in having a Western outpost or a state that would look after the British interests in the Middle East, when the British interests in the Middle East was the route from Britain to its empire in India and the Suez Canal. So initially, I mean, it was the British who were the sponsors of this movement. France became involved. France provided Israel with the foundations of its nuclear program and its nuclear arsenal. The United States didn't pay a whole or a lot of attention to Israel until about 1967, when we have the Six-Day War, or the infamous Six-Day War, in which essentially Israel undertakes a war of aggression against Egypt and, in particular, against the Arab nationalism of Nasser, and essentially humiliates and destroys Nasser, destroys the Arab nationalist movement. And at that point, the United States becomes very interested in Israel as an instrument that it can use to represent its interests in the Middle East and pursue its interests. Mm-hmm. It's also at that point that the so-called special relationship between Israel and the United States begins.
That's a phrase I'm looking for, yes.
And large, you know, subsidies to, or military and also economic subsidies to Israel begin from the United States.
Mm-hmm. To me, most important, there are many important things, of course. The book is full of important matters, but the one that I think that you address that needs to be addressed is the tendency of people, writers, to believe, and I think I'm thinking here, Mr. Mearsheimer and Walt, to have a notion that it's a tail-wagging dog story and that, you know, the great mystery of how Israel dominates the U.S., but you show very thoroughly that that's actually not the case, and that Israel is in a perilous situation in that, like a smaller power, depending upon fortune and weapons from a superpower, they are at the mercy of that power.
They are, and I mean, it's just completely ridiculous to assume that a very small country, I mean, Israel is very small, it only has 8 million people, that it somehow has control over this massive U.S. power of what, over 300 million people.
And 800 foreign bases. It's not helpless.
Exactly. And Israel is in a very perilous position because it's 8 million people in an area surrounded by hundreds of millions of Arabs, and simply in its immediate area. And then going beyond that a little bit more, then we also have tens of millions of Muslims and Arabs who aren't particularly happy with Israel or the idea of settler colonialism or the idea of Israel blocking their national aspirations. So Israel does live within a sea of hostility, and it would not exist very long without the support of the United States. So it has it's a necessity of its survival to be able to cooperate with the United States and ultimately to do the U.S. bidding.
Mm-hmm. Which can be hazardous work. This is Stephen Gallons again, by the way. And you put your finger on a flaw in the outlook of Mearsheimer and Walt, I believe, is saying that they don't understand empire. Or don't even accept that there is an empire.
No, and I think this view that, you know, it's Israel that controls U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East rather than the U.S. using Israel as a platform or an instrument of its foreign policy is a way in which people avoid engaging with the whole notion of imperialism or the United States as an imperialist power, whose imperialism is rooted in the incessant expansion or pushing of its economic and political and ideological frontiers or expanding them incessantly, that I believe is a function of its capitalist economy, because capitalism demands continual expansion. The United States has always been an expansionary power, right from the very moment of its birth as 13, you know, colonies on the collection of 13 colonies on the east coast of North America to quickly become, an empire of continental expanse. It was always called an empire of liberty. Then expanding further to add colonies in the Pacific and the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And now, as you said, with 800 military bases around the world, it's this mm-hmm. continually expanding power. So the way in which the United States behaves in the Middle East is exactly the same as the way in which it behaves elsewhere in the global South. So those who say that, Israel, or the United States' behavior in the Middle East is attributable to Israel and its foreign policy being hijacked by Israel seem to have or be ignoring a lot of things. They're ignoring the fact that the United States behaves in exactly the same way elsewhere in the world.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, it also, that kind of thinking, it carries with it the seeds of anti-Semitism because it's the idea there must be some cabal, right? Instead of seeing that it's an empire that has created colonies all over the place and announces to the world that, for example, everybody in South America must do as they wish, to attribute that to, you know, a cabal somewhere is to ignore what's staring us all in the face.
Yes, absolutely. And it also ignores the fact if you want to say that the U.S. Middle East policy has been hijacked by the Jews and their lobby in Israel, which is wrong, if you're looking for hijacking, then you should say it's been hijacked by corporate America, because that is who exerts the most or the greatest influence in Washington. I mean, people often talk about the enormous Israeli lobby, which is large. But there are lots of lobbies in the United that are large, or just as large. For example, the gun lobby, or the petroleum lobby, or the lobby for retired people. These are all large lobbies. When you look at AIPAC, which everyone points to, and you look at their budget, it's really minuscule against the kind of money that corporate America can bring to bear and does bring to bear in Washington.
Yeah. You also point out that if you want to say special relationship involving money and influence, Saudi Arabia qualifies.
Yes.
Eminently qualified. I mean, they murder people and show up for the next big meeting and everybody pats them on the back.
And that's one of the arguments is, you know, U.S. foreign policy benefits Israel. Well, yes, it does. But it also benefits the United States and it benefits Saudi Arabia. So if it benefits Saudi Arabia, are we going to then argue that there's a Saudi lobby that hijacked U.S. foreign policy?
The book really plainly shows these things. I congratulate you again on the book, Israel, a Beachhead in the Middle East, from European Colony to U.S. Power Projection Platform. I'm afraid we probably have too short of time at the moment. I would like to come back and talk to you some more in the future about some of these issues, such as the Golan Heights business and how this book sheds light on it. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye. Stephen Gowans. Gowans. Yeah, I just heard myself talking. That's a sign that I'm on the air. Phil Conant is here. Have you got the book yet, Phil?
I don't have the book yet, but it's in your hands, though.
It's in my hands.
Yeah, I can take it off you, but I'll...
I'll just tell listeners again. There is a classic book, they call it classic, very important book, by Mearsheimer and Walt. And that is one area where they, to my mind, there's a big distortion. Stephen really addressed it, this thing of, look, it's an empire, created this situation. It created a lot of the Arab states, by the way. Jordan, Lebanon, those are all taken by the colonialists. And so we had this distortion, which was their making. It wasn't a little secret group. This was the interest of great maritime and now, you know, powers that can cover the earth in a few minutes. Anyhow, I hope people get the book. This has been the Taylor Report. Thank Phil Conlon, and thanks to the brilliant staff at CIUT. We've been on the air. We'll see you next week.